All right, everybody, welcome to Athlete on Fire. I'm Scott Jones, your host. We've got another person in the hunting world. As you can tell, as the days go, you can see where my interests kind of lie month to month, year to year, which has been kind of fun. Just talking to this guy about how selfish we can be with our podcast guests when we want to learn things. We know people who are listening want to learn the same things. It's always kind of a good fit. So really excited to bring him on. If you guys want to check out everything on athleteonfire.com, that's a good spot for it. We've got Dan Staton from Elk Shape and the Elk Shape podcast. Everything on his brand is Elk Shape, so you can follow him on all the socials. Dan, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well. You?
I'm just happy you have an easy name. I'm sure you've done enough podcasts where you start getting a little nervous in the intro because you're making sure you don't want to butcher somebody's name. So I'm always kind of stoked about that. That's always a good start.
I've butchered most of the names, honestly. Oh, it's difficult.
It's great. You know, like, when I do these things, I don't like to talk too much off air because it seems like you get into like a normal conversation. Like, oh, this would be good for the show. Oh, this would be good for the show. So I like to dive in pretty early. Where are you at right now, man? Where do you live? How big is your family? How long have you been married? I know some of these details about you, but why don't you share that with the audience?
Yeah, I live in Spokane, Washington. I'm in the inland northwest. Spokane's about 3.5 hour drive east of Seattle. So I'm almost touching the Idaho border. And we have just a little bit more of a four seasons drier climate than Seattle. Been here my whole life. I've done some traveling, but this is home. This is where family's at. Got a beautiful wife named Alicia. She and I have been married for 10 years, and we have two beautiful babies, and they're getting older every day. My daughter is about to start kindergarten, so that makes me very soft inside just to hear that. And then I have my son who's 3 years old, and that's more than enough kids for us right now. Like, that's more than enough to handle, and that's where we're at, and we enjoy all four seasons, although I will say we seem to love summer the best, but it kind of flies by when you live over here.
Yeah. Yeah, I have not been to Spokane. I've been to a lot of your state. I haven't been on that side. What's the feel? Is it mountainous? Is it rolling hills? What's the geography?
You know, Washington's an interesting state. If you haven't spent a lot of time, it's got your rainforest. It's got your, like, pretty much Olympic Mountains, and then your Cascade Mountains, which get a ton of snow and a ton of precip, and they suck up all the moisture. And then middle of the state, super dry, desert vibe, rolling hills, and then you have some ranges to the north. We kind of are in that big pine where the wheat fields kind of end, where the hills start to end, and you get some pines, and then the Rockies kind of take off. So I would say pretty mountainous vibe, although we're only sitting at about 2,200 feet, I'd say. But recreation in every direction. And I would say Spokane's probably one of the better places for summers because we have so many cool lakes nearby, not reservoirs, but lakes. And so everybody's on the water in the summer.
Oh, nice. So you grew up there?
Yep, born and raised.
That's pretty cool. I grew up in South Florida, and there's a reason I don't live there anymore. I love the mountains. I've always loved the mountains. My family's from West Virginia, so even though it's not like West Coast mountains, it's still a beautiful mountainous place, and I don't know how people do it without mountains. It's just kind of crazy. So tell us a little bit about your background. What do you do for – what is Elk Shape? What are you doing with – I'm going to get into the beef of the stuff here in a second, but just setting it up for the audience here.
Yeah, so for the audience listening, I'm a strength and conditioning coach. Still am, always have been. Started out probably like a lot of fitness enthusiasts as just a kid who's 16, had a membership to the gym. That's what I wanted. That's what my mom got me and got really into working out. Fast forward, I did an undergrad and a graduate degree in exercise science, exercise physiology. All that really means is that I'm super interested into the human body and how it works. And it happens to coincide with I really like helping people achieve what they really want. And I don't like helping people that don't really want to change. And you'll learn that if you're a fitness guy or instructor. It's like your time is very limited, so you'd love to work with people. that really want to make a change. And, you know, kind of your slimier clients, hate to say it that way, they're just the people that aren't really ever going to change. They're not in a spot in their life where they really want to do the hard thing. And that can really burn you out. So I started out as a personal trainer, became a manager. So I was managing your global, like your health club, box gyms, got into that, really into that. And then when I finally finished my graduate degree, I really was fortunate to work with some pretty cool companies. One is called Exos. Back then it was called Athletes Performance. A guy named Mark Verstegen, he's written a lot of books and trained so many professional athletes, went down to Arizona and just got hands-on working with professional athletes, MLB, NFL Combine, the whole class of 2005, and really worked with a few key NBA and soccer players, and just was, my mind was blown at how fun and exciting it is to work with the top end athletes and see what you can do with them. And then moved on to a little bit more of like a speed development guy. I really feel like I needed to work on just coaching acceleration, change of direction, deceleration, and improving people's just explosiveness, plyometrics, elasticity. So I really got into that and opened up a speed school in Boise, Idaho, and did that for a year. And then I got the CrossFit bug, and I still do, by the way. Opened up a CrossFit gym, ran that for 11 years, sold that recently. And what I've finally settled in on is that I'm really into helping people create workouts inside their garage gym, inside their, I call it elk parking, but just you park outside your garage and you work out because you have kids and you have a job and you're so busy. So I've been really interested lately in just kind of helping folks create super basic, nothing fancy, but effective workouts in their garage gym. And a lot of my athletes are hunters that want to provide the best protein source on the planet for their family. And so just happens to be that I love hunting. So I've kind of shifted all around from pro athletes to high school athletes to regular folks to CrossFit athletes. And now I'm just helping hunters. But at the end of the day, man, I just love fitness. I love a good workout, and I love a disciplined lifestyle.
No, that's awesome. It's kind of you literally just described pretty much everything in my career except for the getting hunters specifically ready. It's kind of crazy. Working with the guys getting ready for the combine back in 2003 and 2002, came out here, worked with elite athletes, found out there's a lot more endurance athletes. So you had just a lot of recreational athletes out here that had disposable income or doing triathlon and long runs and stuff, and kind of switched into some of that world. And it's just, it's kind of crazy. I have my master's in exercise science like you do. Where'd you get your degree at?
Eastern Washington University.
Okay.
Go Eagles.
No, that's funny.
And, yeah.
What was the name of Verstegen, right?
Yeah. Mark Verstegen. His wife, Amy, is from Spokane. And her brother, Johnny, I knew him, and I was bold enough at the time to just say, hey, I need an internship to finish my graduate degree. I really want to go to your brother-in-law's place. And he was like, oh, yeah, no problem. I'll make a call. And so I felt like super blessed to get in there. And, man, was I hungry when I showed up. I ate it up.
What was the name of his gym down there in Arizona?
Athletes Performance.
Athletes Performance, cool. Because that was when, do you remember Velocity, that training facility that kind of went around
yes.
the country a little bit? Yeah.
Yes.
What, did he have anything to do with that?
No, he wrote the book Core Performance, and he had like up to 6 Athletes Performance locations at one point. Okay. I don't know. I lost touch. Exos is the new name. They do some corporate training too. At the end of the day, it's really good training. Pretty fancy. Pretty fancy, not as much grassroots as like it's my evolution was kind of backwards. Like I got into the deepest, most fanciest, sports specific, all the specificity, and then I fell in love with the basic CrossFit stuff style. And I read their doctrine, and I really dug some of their principles, still do, and got into that. But yeah, no, all of it's good, you know.
Yeah, Yeah, for sure. No, that's really cool. So when you're thinking, actually, and talking about that garage workout, I was telling you before, I always love our guests to have some kind of workout for you guys who are listening to that you can actually take from this podcast and go try out today or tomorrow or sometime soon, just to see what it feels like to train for the type of stuff that, that hunters are training for specifically today. So we'll do that here in a little bit. When you're getting into, how did Elk Shape start? Were you just at the CrossFit gym thinking, man, this really works for hunters. I need to create my own thing that's real, even more specific? Or what was the impetus to start a brand and a podcast for it?
Yeah, so it's actually doesn't have a lot to do with fitness at all. Been elk hunting since 2001, and it literally is the one thing that motivates me to almost do everything. And let me explain that. So you'll hear guys say, man, I got to get into elk shape, because elk don't live anywhere flat. They live in the mountains. They live real high up. They're a big animal, 600 to 800 pounds, especially the male, the bulls, and they can cover ground. And to really hunt them, you got to be in shape, because you usually have a backpack on that's somewhere between 20 and 50 pounds, depending on if you're overnight or you're just, either way, 20 pound minimum, trying to keep up with four-legged animal. And I'm an archery hunter, so I'm trying to get within under 50 yards of an animal that wants to live and doesn't want anything to do with man. So guys will always say, you got to get into elk shape. And I always thought that was a cool term, but I put a spin on it. I was like, you know, elk shape doesn't have to do with your heart and lungs and muscles. It's really more of like where you at in your life. And so for me, I put elk hunting way up on priority, and I kind of run my life through that filter. So in starting with just my family, like to go elk hunting, you have to leave your family to go do that. So you better make sure that your wife supports what you're doing. She's on board. Everybody's love tank is filled to the brim before you go. And I happen to go for weeks at a time, which is pretty hard with little ones and full-time jobs and all that. But and then it starts with your finances. Elk hunting's not cheap. Out-of-state tags, like, I don't know if a lot of your audience doesn't hunt, but for those that are maybe not anti-hunters but just don't, they're indifferent, hunting is not what you see on TV. Hunting is really difficult, very challenging. I like that. And then you're getting this meat for your family, and an elk can almost feed an entire family for a year. You're buying a hunting license and a hunting tag, and all those dollars go towards the Department of Wildlife, depending on each state. And each state agency runs the wildlife. And those elk are not your elk, Scott. They're not my elk. They're our elk. And we have our states manage their populations and make sure that they don't overpopulate or underpopulate. So hunters' dollars basically make up the bulk of that budget to hire biologists, to hire airplanes and helicopters to do flyover studies and to get boots on the ground and to create habitat and protect the environment for the animals. All that's sponsored by hunters, which is kind of a dichotomy. I get it. You're like, so you're telling me the people that actually want to kill these things are the ones that are keeping them around? And the answer is yes. Yep. That's exactly right, because we see a value, and so we are willing to pay insane amount of dollars and tax ourselves on our weapons, ammo, and hunting gear. There's a tax that we are charged, and all that goes towards conservation. So elk shape filter, running my family, my finances, and my lifestyle choices through that. So when I started realizing, hey man, I'm really pretty disciplined on my all these things, from my family, my faith, my finances, and my fitness, because I love elk hunting and it's keeping me motivated 365. How can I get a brand out there that preaches to these people like, hey, you are blessed to be an elk hunter? Not very many people will wake up at 5 a.m. in the darkest days of winter to go train in their cold garage because they want to go kill an elk. Right. Let's use this. Let's leverage elk hunting to create the best possible versions of ourselves. And that's where Elk Shape began in 2013. And then I think I started the podcast about 2 years ago. And that's kind of really built some momentum. And I centered the podcast around just your regular, everyday, blue-collar elk hunter. and help people with the elk hunting learning curve, because you don't just go pick up, like, you're going elk hunting probably your first time this year.
Yep.
It took me 7 years to get an elk.
Yeah.
7 years of buying an out-of-state tag. I think the math was like somewhere around just $4,000 worth of license and tags over 7 years
till
I finally got one.
Wow.
That was an education.
Don't you think for people who are listening who have no idea what the dollars are, like for Colorado, just over the counter, either sex archery tag, it's like $55 for me. If my buddy's coming from out of state, it's upwards of $600 or $700. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's a lot of money, you know, and that's pretty similar for a lot of the Western states, isn't it?
Yeah. And you know, the elk don't live in these big towns and cities. They live out by these really podunk rural towns. So these hunters showing up in their diesel trucks and their big fifth wheels or campers, they're gassing their rigs up. They're buying groceries. They're pumping money into these small town economies that count on it. And it's great for everybody. And at the end of the day, it's a real robust system, because hunters' dollars make that wildlife world go round. And once you kind of explain it in those terms, I think people can start to understand, okay, maybe hunting's not just about killing. And if you look at the success rates, like there in Colorado, your state, I don't think they hover much higher than 10%. So if you have 10,000 guys with an out-of-state elk tag, only 1,000 are going to get an elk.
Right.
And so there's 9,000, you know, that didn't get an elk but still spent the money, the gas, the time, the energy to get there to help, you know. So it's really actually – pretty awesome. And most elk, you know, most female elk get pregnant and have at least one calf, if not two. And then so you're having and your state has the largest elk population by far. And it's really an awesome conservation model, great environment, great system for elk to do really well. And so it's been exciting to watch Colorado grow and grow and grow, and they can hold the elk, which is awesome.
I think that the one thing that really kind of hit home for me, because I've been, like I told you, I've been almost cramming for this. I have zero expectations going out in the woods this year. Like I told you offline, I'm just trying to learn the skills that I need to be, you know, somewhat ethical or very ethical when we go out in the woods for this first go. So you got to kind of pick and choose what you can't learn everything in a matter of months. So I've been picking and choosing. But I think the one thing that really made sense to me, just from the educational part of it, to be able to explain to other people how the tag system works, is that it's based on a surplus that conservationists are tracking at a pretty high level. You could probably explain that maybe in a minute way better than I could. How, when they're giving out these tags and saying there's a surplus in this state or in that state based on the information and research that we've done, what does that mean? Why is it important to harvest and get rid of some of the animals for the environment?
Well, basically, these animals are going to surpass their capacity if they continue to breed and breed and breed and grow and grow and grow. So we have to selectively harvest a certain percentage each year to keep them, you know, at their carrying capacity of the land. And I know for a fact Colorado is growing every day. I have friends that live in Denver, and they just tell me about how much traffic has changed in the 10 years that they've lived there. And so you have a carrying capacity of the land, and we pay people to monitor and watch that. And if the animal's population is going to exceed that, you're going to have some conflict. You're going to have, you know, depredation. And then that depredation will happen within the state, where the state will actually have to go out and kill these animals because they're exceeding the carrying capacity. And so what they figured out is, well, let's let hunters play that role. They'll pay good money to do it. They'll eat the meat, and we'll have a great conservation model, and we'll have an awesome budget to work with. And so that's kind of how the model is, and it's monitored so closely, because wildlife's super important to all of us. And I think everyone could agree that they want wildlife, you know, where they live, and they want them to carry on. So it's just a real tight knit system that is monitored extremely well, and it does cost a lot of money to monitor it. And so fortunately, hunters' dollars through the Pittman-Robinson Act, that's the tax I was talking about, as well as the tags and license fees, go towards that budget.
Awesome. That's great explanation. I think, you know, anytime you're interviewing somebody that's in a niche, if you can just get the basics out there for people who are listening who might have the interest, it's awesome. Just to be able to have those arguments with people. Not even arguments, just to be able to get that information across the line to other individuals who don't understand it. It's pretty cool. Okay, so we were talking, I've had a couple buddies ask me about this, and I don't know enough to be intelligent on it, but I know there has been a discussion about reintroduction of wolves to Colorado. And I know they've done it up in Montana near Yellowstone, and they're growing like mad up there. I don't know numbers or anything, but from a general philosophy, what are your general thoughts on that?
I'm gonna try to tread lightly here. So wolves are something that a lot of people have, I'd say the majority of people have never seen with their own two eyes, have never heard them. So they're very mystical and almost ominous and beautiful and a little bit probably hyped on how cool they are. I'm going to just cut to the point. To me, a wolf is just a dog. It lifts its leg to pee. It kills other dogs. It's very much an apex predator animal that can run and cover hundreds of miles effortlessly, and they live in packs. They feed off meat. They don't eat grass, plants, nothing. They're flesh, man. They eat flesh. And so before a lot of the out west was settled, there was a few here and there. I'm not sure if they ever were in Colorado. I could be wrong, but if they were, they were taken care of by settlers, ranchers, because they don't coexist with cattle. So if you're not a vegan and you like beef, ranchers do not like wolves because wolves will come in and kill. Now they'll surplus kill. They'll just kill when they're hungry. They'll kill when they're not hungry. Their killers don't hate the wolf. They're just a wolf, man. They have one objective, and that's to kill. And people get really emotional about it, and I try not to, just because it's an animal, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
it's a wild dog, and it's a very efficient killer. So here in Washington, we have wolves, quite a few. Our state says we have 124. I think that's what they said, 124. I don't know how they keep track of that, honestly. A certain amount of established packs and breeding pairs, so male and female, and so on and so forth. And we do not have any hunting seasons for them, so they're kind of under federal protection. And we have on the news constantly where our fishing game here has to go and kill an entire pack that has killed several ranchers' cattle. And what ends up happening is fishing game will go out there and try to disperse the wolf and get them out of the area. And they'll try all these things, and it doesn't work because it's a wild animal. And eventually a line is drawn in the sand, and then we spend our tax dollars to hire fishing game to go out and kill these wolves. And then it's just like, what's the point? Yeah. What's the point? And then in Idaho, there was wolves planted in the Clinton administration in the mid 90s. And they were, you know, somebody had a great idea, like, hey, let's bring wolves back. Like, they're really cool. So they transplanted quite a few from Canada into Yellowstone area and places in Idaho. And they've since grown to where there's so many that they've actually had to have hunting seasons come back. So you can legally hunt wolves in Montana, Idaho, I'm pretty sure Wyoming, not obviously in Yellowstone Park, but I believe Washington State and parts of northern Idaho have always had wolves coming and going across. They don't have borders. So I think there's always been a few wolves coming over. But my opinion on this thing is just like, we used to have a caribou population 2 hours north of here in Spokane in the lower 48, right above Priest Lake. And they study those animals very closely. And they've gone from like, I don't know how many, not too long ago, 50, 60, 70, down to zero.
Wow.
Primarily wolf predation, some cougar for sure, but primarily wolves took them all out. and then we have Wolves here in northeastern Washington with no regulations, so they're hitting ungulates pretty hard. And then over in my neck of the woods in Idaho where I hunt, I have seen over 100 wolves with my two eyeballs while elk hunting, and like 100.
That's
a lot of different wolves. Like, no, I'm not talking just hearing them howl. I'm talking like up close and in person interactions with them. And so I've seen them, and I'm just like, man, they are a dog that just kills, and they have really big litters, and they're really good at reproducing. So my redneck response is like, hey, dude, the ranchers got rid of them for a reason. They're a menace to society. And then the other side of me, like the more like student ecologist, biologist, like, well, it wouldn't hurt to have some wolves, but they definitely need to be managed and not overpopulated, because ultimately, if you have more wolves, they will eat themselves out of house and home without regulation. And what will end up happening is they'll eat every ungulate, and then they'll starve. And when they're starving, they're going to have more man conflict.
It's all gone.
Yeah. And it's a vicious cycle. So you can't make everybody happy, but if we all put our emotions inside and say, look, the wolves, I'll tell you this much, they're not going anywhere. You're not going to get rid of them. You can only get rid of them probably the way the ranchers did hundreds of years ago, which is just straight up poisoning carcasses and them eating that and dying. You're not going to go hunt wolves down and kill them all. Never going to happen. They're too amazing.
Yep.
But you got to have a balance out there. And I, for one, don't go to Yellowstone to see beavers and birds. I would go to Yellowstone to see like bison, the elk rut, elk bugling, grizzly bears. And if people wanted to see – but I think a lot of people go to Yellowstone now to see wolves. Well, the wolves aren't going to be there much longer, because the elk population in Yellowstone was upwards of 19,000 pre-wolf. And then the reintroduction, and I think I don't know the accurate numbers, but I'm going to say somewhere around the 2,000 to 3,000 mark.
Wow, that's crazy.
And maybe that's what they wanted. I'm not sure. They said that some willows were growing back. I've seen some pro-wolf propaganda, and it's like, well, now we have these willows growing back, so now we have the beavers coming back. We've gotten rid of the coyotes. Well, that's cool, guys, but I mean – I'd rather see an elk bugling at Yellowstone with my family than just some willows, beavers, and some wolves, you know.
Yeah.
It's just everybody's got to come to some sort of, I don't know, agree to disagree, but hey, we got to like compromise. What do we want for our future? So to bring wolves into Colorado, I think, would be a terrible idea. I don't think the model's gone too well up here in Washington, Idaho, and Montana, Wyoming. And we just continue to have conflicts. Wolves continue to get killed regardless by fish and game agencies when enough's enough. And so I just read in the paper a couple weeks ago, a guy here in Spokane just killed a wolf out of protection, him and his daughter. And of course, fish and game does a big investigation. They cleared him. He was within his right to protect himself. And so I think that's just the beginning, and I'm really worried about that. So I don't know, man.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely nuanced. I mean, there's a lot going on there. I think I've never hunted a day in my life besides when I was a kid going out with my grandpa, you know, like just going out and on his property lines. And so I don't even have a dog in the fight, literally, yet, but it doesn't make sense to have one predator kind of destroy all of the resources. It just doesn't, from a common sense standpoint. And I haven't even had this argument or this intellectual talk with anybody, really. I've looked at a couple of headlines. I'm kind of curious. I'm in this country. We go up north in Wyoming a fair amount, and I like that countryside. I like seeing big animals out in the woods. And yeah, it's good. It's good. Thanks for that. All right. So a little more before we get into some of the fun, quicker hitter type stuff. I've listened to your podcast a few times. I love that you're really passionate about family life and, people working hard with their job and making the time to work hard in the woods with their passions and stuff. I think that's really cool. And you always talk about at least I think I've listened to two or three episodes in the last week or so, about having your home right before you go out in the woods. And September is generally archery season. So when you say that, I have a feeling that you've maybe messed up in the past to be so passionate about it. Do you have an example of a time that you did not have your home all set up for a hunt? Maybe you're stressed or anxious out there because you knew you didn't do what you should have done. And maybe if you could frame that as a learning point for someone else to not make the same mistake. I'm just assuming here.
Yeah, no, I think that it's really hard for hunters to admit that there's a degree of selfishness going into hunting where I'm leaving you guys for a week, 10 days, a month, what have you, and I'm just going to go hunting. You take care of the bills. You take care of the kids. You take care of the house, and I'll get back with you when I'm back. You know, no, I just have always empathized with my wife, who isn't a hunter, isn't passionate about elk hunting. She does enjoy having a freezer full of wild game and not having to go to the store and buy meat. So she does understand that I am my best self when I come back from elk hunting season. It's just kind of part of who I am. It really resets and gets my mind right. And I don't know if I've ever really made a mistake, but I am all or none. And so that's just, it is what it is. She's married a guy who's all or nothing on everything he does. And that just kind of goes with the territory. But I feel like I can relate to guys that do have families more than don't, and that I understand the price tag involved with going hunting, and nothing in this world is free. And if you're going to go and leave your family, I just feel like somebody's got to be a voice for the family man to say, to remind them, hey, we as men, you cannot hunt your best if you didn't make the burden of you being gone mitigated or minimized as much as possible. I'm getting ready to leave this Friday, and I have an open-ended 3-tag season where I'm going into 3 different states to hunt elk, and I don't know when I'm going to be home, but probably somewhere around September 30th. And so that is a lot on my wife's shoulders. She has 2 jobs. She was a nurse for a school. She's a nurse for a hospital. We have 2 little ones. I'm an entrepreneur. And so we have just all these things going on. It's not super fair. So I just know for me to hunt my best personally, I got to rest assured that everything's taken care of. And I have to be intentional way ahead of time, get a calendar out, let her know what I'm thinking, where I'm going. And then all the logistics behind one kid's in school, one kid's not, childcare, nannying, yeah, appointments, gymnastics, sports, school, her job, all this stuff, her time. So I just think as a decent human being and a, you know, somebody who really loves their wife and wants the best for them, you have to be intentional. And so that's why I've always stressed that. I can't say there's just one example of me. Like, I've always, ever since I've been married for 10 years and before that, I've always pretty much hunted all of September. So it's not like what you think where you're like, well, I bet your wife's used to that by now. No, she's never gotten used to it. It's always hard. And it put yourself in her shoes. So I've always just thought like, hey, I'll be the guy to like remind guys to just take a step back and do your due diligence at home. And especially the 10 months that you are home, put the phone down. I always say that, put your phone down and engage with your family. Be present in the evenings and really make sure that when you are gone, you know, they actually notice. Because if you're there but you're not there, you're doing a disservice to your family.
Yeah, no, that's good stuff, man. And, you know, me and my wife are both entrepreneurs. We met on a chairlift snowboarding. We have very similar interests. But one thing we've always said is if we don't continue to adventure and do the things that we've always done on our own, then we're not going to grow in the same way. And that's what attracted mm-hmm. us to each other. So if we only have the same experiences, which is a domestic life for a lot of people, then we're not bringing anything new to the table on a regular basis. And I think when you go out in the woods and you reset and you, even if you don't harvest anything, you kind of feel this calm take over you and you can be there even more present when you come back. And I think we got to find ways, you know, me and my wife have a good balance on that, find ways for each of us to go get that adventure that we need. And it's going to, I don't know, it's just always been a good formula for us. So
yeah, well said.
It's on the same thing. All right. So, I'm about to go hunt for the first time. I might get out for 4 or 5 days this September. Zero expectations. I just want to go out and experience it and see what it's like to be out there and you know what I should be looking at. You can only read so much and listen to so much. You got to go out and experience things. And I'm very experienced in the woods, just not hunting. So there's a few things that I thought would be kind of fun to do with you, like some quick hitters. So what would be like five tools from a technology standpoint that I should have at my disposal as a new hunter or even as an experienced hunter? The technology that we have. Yeah, like the technology.
The technology?
That we have
today. Yeah. Okay. Well, what we're doing right now is huge. Podcasts are awesome. I didn't have them when I started elk hunting. And so I just had to go learn on my own. There's so much amazing information out there via podcasts. So many niche little topics. There's hundreds of thousands of podcasts nowadays. You can really hone in on the ones and learn so much and shorten that learning curve. Same with YouTube. YouTube's got a lot of resources on how to find elk, how to scout, how to backpack, what to put in your backpack. So just logistics-wise and just being a mountain man, so to speak, being a woodsman, being efficient in the mountains, and being fully prepared. The digital resources are amazing. Another thing on digital would be Google Earth. Google Earth Pro is a free program, didn't used to be, where you can literally fly over where you want to hunt, get tilt the axis of the earth, and get a really good idea of what the mountains look like. Drop pins and layers and figure out where to park and where to do your loops and where to camp and where the north-facing cooler slopes are where the elk will sleep during the day and where the south-facing slopes where they're going to get feed and cover and water, all the things that the animals need. It's super basic, but you can do that from your desktop. So there's three. And then the two things that I take with me when I'm hunting would be my cell phone. I have a smartphone and I have OnX Hunt. It's an app. And they basically have, you can pull up right where you're at, make sure that you know the boundaries of your unit, your set area where you can elk hunt, make sure that you're on public land, so you're on BLM, DNR, or National Forest, or Wilderness, and you're not on private property, and it shows ownership of private, so you're not trespassing and you're legal. That's really important, as well as it works as a GPS, and you can drop waypoints and really feel like you're not lost and have a good lay of the land. That's I run that all the time. You can track your steps, figure out how far you've gone. So that's really nice. And then I have a Garmin InReach, which I think a lot of just regular hikers use.
Yeah.
That's a subscription GPS unit that I use where I can send out a text, regardless if I have cell phone, to my wife with some presets saying, "Hey, honey, I'm home. I'm back at camp. I'm safe. I'm sound. I'm thinking of you. I love you. Talk to you soon." And I can actually get texts and in case something's wrong and get to a cell phone. So the technology is huge. It's changed the game so much. And I feel so much, I hunt solo. So it keeps me really safe and it lets me, and I have an SOS button if I need to use it. And so the technology is awesome and I've really embraced it.
Nice. Yeah. We work with a lot of runners. I have a podcast called Becoming Ultra, and a lot of those runners are using InReach on a regular basis. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So one piece of etiquette for a new hunter who's hunting with other people, that might not be obvious. Is there something that, I know you said you hunt alone, but are there things that you know that would drive you crazy or would drive other hunters crazy because someone didn't know this one thing?
Here's an example. Like, let's say you're new and you hooked up with some good friends that want to take you along. Okay. And they bring you into one of their really good elk hunting spots. And they're like, "Hey, I'm going to take you into our spot. You guys get into great elk hunting." And then let's say like a year goes by and you lose touch with those guys. And then the very next year, you go right into the spot that they showed you. And they're in there and like, "Hey." And you bring a new friend and your friend brings a friend. That's really not cool. Like, yeah. As far as ethics go, that's like, do you know how long it took them to probably find that amazing elk hunting spot? And you just kind of abused the privilege that they brought you in there. So I've had that happen to me a lot where I've taken people into places that I've, you know, took me decade to learn this awesome spot, because that really does matter. And so poaching other people's spot is what I call that. It's just like maybe backcountry skiing or something. There's a really cool line that only you know about. Like, and then all of a sudden now your friends is in there. It's just, so learn your own spots. And if someone takes you into their spot, respect that and always communicate ahead of time if that's something that you want to go check out and make sure it's cool.
That's awesome. I mean, yeah, I grew up in South Florida fishing, and it's the same exact thing, of course.
Same thing.
Yep. I don't know. It's amazing that's not common sense, though.
You'd be surprised.
That just boggles my mind. Especially out here. All right, so we said earlier we're going to give a good workout for listeners. I mean, if you don't know what hauling, even just covering the countryside that the elk kind of live, just being there is you have to be pretty fit. But to haul one out, when you said how big they are and how heavy they are, I've just heard crazy stories of just crazy packouts with amazing distance covered on really rugged land. So there's a lot of things that need to be done. What's a good workout that prepares people that you can give right now that they can go give a shot?
Oh, okay. You know, I'm kind of against the grain, and your ultra audience might not even like what I'm about to say, so forgive me, but I don't do anything long, slow distance. And yet when you pack an elk out, you can't take the whole elk out in one trip. As long as I've lived, I've never killed one by a road or by a truck. So it's always at least four trips going to get the meat to the truck, turn around, and do that over and over. So it's all long, slow distance, steady heart rate, nothing super anaerobic. Conversely, all I train is pretty much anaerobic, high output, high intensity, short duration pieces to prepare myself. And I feel like that is the one energy system. If you really hammer those, say, 2 to 20 minute hard all out pieces, or even interval based training, they generally lend themselves well to the other things, the long, slow distance ones. So you won't catch me doing like, oh, it's Saturday, I'm going to do a 12-mile run. That's not going to be me. I don't do a ton of backpacking prior to the season. I do a lot of cross training, and I think the magic is in the movement. So some of the most important movements that I do under duress, what I mean by that is I don't do a set and rest. I do multiple things back to back, as a thruster, which is like a front squat to shoulder press all in one movement, very explosive. Like, that is going to invite a lot of muscles to the party. There's going to be a lack of oxygen. There's going to be a surplus of lactate building in your muscles. And so, yeah, like thrusters, a good back squat, a good deadlift, some Olympic lifts that are lighter loads with good technique. Always good technique. Got to preach that. But I like big compound movements that elicit power. And I like to do them under duress and really get the most bang for my buck. Rarely would I train for longer than 40 to 50 minutes. But I'm not messing around. I'm doing a really good warm-up, a really specific warm-up, and then I'm getting after it, and then I'm doing a cool-down, some mobility, and I'm out. So to answer your question, like, pick four or five movements, get a rep scheme, set a clock, measure and manage, and go hard, and I think you'll get the most bang for your buck.
Nice. All right, couple yes or no questions here. Are newbies good for the sport of hunting or not?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. Beer, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, what kind?
I'm kind of a microbrew guy. I don't really drink like light beers. So anything local and micro and a little hoppy, I'm in. IPAs.
Nice. This is not a yes or no question, but what's the coolest wildlife experience you've had not on a hunt?
Oh, everybody should go to Banff. Did a backpacking trip in the wilderness with my wife, and we were very close to a lot of grizzly bears, and it was really special.
That's really cool. All right, here's the last one. For people who are married to or friends with hunters, and they give you some free meat, what of the game that you hunt typically, what is going to be the biggest shock to the system for someone who's not used to eating wild game?
I don't know. I think they'll be surprised at how tender and tasteful it is, and that it's so lean and bright red. There's not fat in it. It's really how meat was intended to be consumed. I think they'll be appreciative of the leanest, reddest meat on the planet.
Is it okay to trick people to get to eat wild game?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've had, back when I owned my gym, I had all the coaches come over, and I made bear steaks, and I didn't tell them it was bear.
Oh,
and they all ate it or whatever. And I don't even know if it got brought up. I just they all know I'm a hunter. They probably assumed they were going to be eating wild game. I didn't know if they were going to assume we were going to be eating bear, but bear's one of those meats that's got like this stigma of it's not good, and it's actually some of the best meat. I usually kill a spring bear every year, and their diet's almost 100% grass. So it's literally like grass-fed. It's unreal. So I think it's okay, but I don't know about intentionally tricking people. I would say that's probably just tell them up front if they might be concerned or whatever. But I think they'd always be surprised that it's really pretty darn good.
Oh, I think that's awesome, man. This has been a great talk. I know we had a little time limit on this thing. I want to give you a chance. I know you have some online camps and some offline camps. You were mentioning it before we hopped on the call here. So go ahead. Let people know what you got going on, man.
So Elk Shaped, we do camps. And what we do is we have an online version, but we do the live ones. And those are probably the most impactful. We have 6 or 7 scheduled for 2020. We're traveling all around. And if you can make it to one and you're interested in either becoming an elk hunter or learning how to be a better elk hunter, that's for you. What you don't probably want to hear, but it's the truth, is that I don't even care if you kill an elk. When I'm gone, when I leave that camp, you better be better at life. And so I'm going to hit you with how to set goals, how to become financially independent and not a slave to a clock or working for somebody that you're miserable about, how to be the best family person, and how to be extremely fit and improve your longevity. Oh, and how to kill elk. Like, we'll cover that too in depth. But, and then what I decided was like, the internet's so cool, I might as well just make the online version. So we film every camp we do, and we load up 30 to 40 videos a camp. And so it's like you can attend a camp right there. So we have an online version as well. And those are our digital products. We have workout programs, nutrition programs too. But I'm really excited about the camp side of things because I think it will really catapult people's lives in the direction they really want to go. Life is short. You should wake up excited and happy every day to do what it is that you do, and you should be called to do it. And if you're not doing that, you're wasting time and you're wasting your gifts. And I don't think that anyone should do that. So that's why I get fired up about Elk Shaped Camp.
Awesome, man. I know you're about to pack up and get out of town for a little bit, so I respect your time. Awesome chatting with you, man. We'll do this again sometime, maybe after the madness that is the fall. So thanks a lot for your time. You guys go check out elkshaped.com. Thanks, Dan.
You bet, Scott. Appreciate it.